Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next on Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR. Good morning to you. My name is Jay Moran. Today, we're going to be talking about a report coming out of the UB School of Law that takes a look at the realities of immigration enforcement. It's called Ending Complicity, the Harms of State and Local Collusion with Federal Immigration Enforcement. With us from UB Law School, Paul Lyndon Reddick. Thanks for joining us, sir.
Thanks so much for having me.
A pleasure. And this is quite the extensive report that takes a look at the realities of what immigration enforcement and its impact on our local community. We're talking about our local community because it involves everybody, right? It's not just people who've lived here for 50 years, 100 years, whatever their family's case been, but in some cases, obviously, in the specific cases what we're talking about here, people who are relatively new to the country. Let's just get into the first and foremost methods. How did you go about compiling this report?
Yeah, so this was a product of students in the human rights practicum at the law school, working for about a year and a half, conducting dozens of interviews with impacted individuals, community activists, local attorneys who are working on these immigration cases, doing research in international law, in constitutional law, in public policy, and compiling information, direct testimony about the experiences that individuals in Western New York had in the immigration context. But we our framing of it was, of course, we know how severe the federal immigration policies have become and how the actions of ICE have been. But our kind of question was, what does the layer of cooperation between federal immigration and state and local agencies, police, but not only police, how does that exacerbate the harms that we face and that these communities face? It was about a year and a half of intensive research and writing and compiling, working with partner organizations. This report is the product of conversations that we had with the New York Immigration Coalition. We knew from the beginning that that the New York for All Act was being, for several years now, is being debated in the state legislature. Given the severity of the conditions that people are facing, we believe that it was important to kind of have an account of exactly how people are facing situations that cooperation between state agencies and federal immigration enforcement, how that exacerbates and how that feeds people into deportation proceedings, removal proceedings, or has other impacts on their lives. To tell that story was an essential part of a broader kind of public consciousness raising campaign and advocacy campaign, ultimately to push for the passage of New York for All.
Let's allow me to speak on behalf of the rhetoric, I guess, that we've heard coming out. I can recall the former Secretary for Homeland Security, or the who was in charge of immigration, the former governor of North Dakota, going on television with commercials, reminding people that they're here illegally, and this concept that, it's everybody's job to let authorities know that there are people here are illegally. I'm of course paraphrasing to a certain extent, but I think I'm doing it with some accuracy here, that it is everybody's job to let authorities know that there may be somebody who is not here legally. So we have that as kind of like the mainstream thought for lack of a better term, or the mainstream thought that's been debated. But you're looking at it from a more legal standpoint. What's lost? What are the things that are lost or missing in that, I guess, supposition that if they're here illegally, it is your job as an American citizen or a member of whatever community, law enforcement, education, social services, to help authorities find these people?
Yeah, it's a perfect question. That mindset, which is totally understandable, right? But that privileges an enforcement of the law. It has a kind of enforcement mentality. What you lose is precisely what we wanted to foreground in the report, which is the human rights aspect, right? That irrespective of whether you maybe violated the law, you are still a human being, you still have some kind of status in society, you are protected by the law, and your rights should be protected by public actors foremost, but by everybody. And so the orientation of simply, we will look out for people who have violated the law contact the authorities, right? That might sound kind of intuitive, right? But I think it has human rights implications that we have to be really mindful of. And, you know, we don't do that for most other kinds of forms of violations.
Right. You know, not calling somebody because I saw them speeding down the street.
Exactly, right? And mm-hmm. you might think that, we want to report crimes, right? And certainly serious crimes, right? There, of course, are difficult conversations about getting police involved because we know that the use of force is a very delicate thing. Do we want to actually call the police when we don't know how that might escalate? There's all sorts of very fraught things that you might as a private citizen think about before you maybe contact the police, no matter how much you trust them kind of in the abstract. But we want to be careful here, right? When we talk about someone being in the country illegally, and this is, I think, well known to your listeners, those are typically not criminal violations, right? Those are civil violations. It's the equivalent of a kind of a parking ticket, right? Is something that's punished by not by the criminal justice system, right? So I think that there's when the secretary goes and says that we have to watch out for illegal behavior, I think that the kind of the subtext there is that we're assigning them a criminal status, right? A status of being dangerous, when that's just simply not true at all. And so I think that there's a little bit of that rhetoric kind of amplifying that element of criminality and danger when these are far and away civil violations, someone overstaying a visa, someone having their asylum application denied and still being in the country. None of these things are criminal. None of these things poses a threat to people in the way that I think illegality or criminality is meant to convey. And so I think we want to kind of soften that aspect and instead of foreground and privilege a view that says, listen, you might have done something wrong, but you still have rights as an individual. And if the way that our country has decided to enforce these laws, if that mode of enforcement violates your rights, then we should do something about it, right? That we can't enforce our law by any means that we feel is necessary, right? We have limits on government power for a reason. And so the report tries to say the way that we in Western New York, by allowing our state and local agencies to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement, the way that we have chosen to enforce our immigration laws through that mechanism leads to serious violations of human rights that should never happen. And if you look at it that way, right, then the idea of simply going out in the street and reporting on every single person you think might be here illegally comes to look a lot like complicity in serious wrongdoing on your part. And not to carry the analogy too far, but I think, you know, I was born in Czechoslovakia, where we had a police state. And their citizens reported on one another all the time. Mm. And it completely devastated this level of social trust and public trust, because you never knew who was going to potentially tell the police that you were up to no good on the basis of what kind of evidence, right? It was completely, you would create 1,000 petty tyrants being willing to use certain information against you. That completely devastates public trust in a community. It completely devastates the sense that people actually can go out and enjoy their lives, make friends, grow. That is a destructive to a community, certainly like Buffalo, but I think to any community that wants to have a sense that it has a modicum of solidarity, a modicum of equality and social standing. So I think if you foreground human rights as the lens that you see immigration enforcement through, then that aspect of, well, if someone's here legally, then everyone should know about it, comes to look a lot like an abuse of power and not just simply enforcing the law.
I may break down 1,000 petty tyrants and put that up on a sign for sure for everybody to see. Let's use and we can probably go throughout the program, because we have you for the next hour, of some of the different examples of the of what you and your students have seen and who they've talked to. But maybe just take us just one that stands out, an example of a situation where, like you said, international human rights clearly violated in this example, where perhaps a state official, a local official, whomever, was complicit with ICE authorities.
Yeah, and I want to kind of do justice to the work that the students did, because it was a challenging report because we took a very broad view, right? So we obviously were focused in some respect on public safety and the kind of interactions with police, because that's so prominent. So Questions of due process and equal protection. But what we wanted to broaden the aperture a little bit and say, well, things like the right to education or the right to healthcare or the right to employment, those things are guaranteed under international human rights law to you, irrespective of your immigration status, right? So you have a right to a safe working environment, right? You should be free from wage exploitation, notwithstanding your status, right? You can, the state can enforce its immigration laws how it wants, but once you're employed, right, it has to make sure that you're not being exploited in the workplace. We also focused in particular on the rights of refugees and asylees to integrate into the community, because those are expressly guaranteed in not just international law, but also in our statutory provisions as well. One thing that I think stands out is in this account, I think the story that we lead the report with is the story of Anderson Contreras Hernandez. This story has been covered extensively by the Investigative Post locally, but I think it kind of travels across many areas that we cover. And so that's why we kind of open the report with it. This is a young man, 19, 20 years old. He has come through. He's from Venezuela originally. He and his family, his mother and his father and his brother, they make the difficult passage from Venezuela. They flee gang violence. They are persecuted by the state and by the gangs in Venezuela under the previous Maduro regime. They make that awful trek that I think we've all read about, through Panama, through the Darien Gap. They miraculously make it through. They cross the border. They are sent to New York City. They're eventually part of that group that was bused to Buffalo from New York.
Infamous.
They are, you know, granted humanitarian parole into the country. They are they file asylum applications, so they're asylum seekers. The father gets work authorization to work. So does Anderson. This is a family that's trying to hold their life together. The boys, but Anderson in particular, has sickle cell anemia. So he has a difficult medical condition, requires serious levels of care. One reason why they ended up leaving is because Venezuela could not offer that care. So there's a whole question of fleeing persecution, being protected as a refugee under international refugee law, being a young person, having a medical condition. And so all these are kind of vulnerabilities that international human rights law is alive to and it wants to protect. And he is here in Buffalo, about almost a year after he is arrested in the Walden Galleria, right, for a petty larceny. He bought a bunch of items. It's alleged that he didn't pay for, you know, a pair of underwear. The Cheektowaga police is called. This is a small crime that normally would have led to simply a notice to appear. It wouldn't, so no one would be taken back to the station at all, right? This is a kind of low level offense. The Cheektowaga police officer is uncertain about who this person is. He looks at the documentation that he has for the work authorization. This is a formal, a federal piece of ID. The police officer doesn't quite know what to make of it. He ostensibly thinks that it might be forged, and he wants to identify who this person is. He detains Anderson in order to be able to do that longer than he would have if it were just a normal stop and response to that particular crime, right? And whom does he call? He calls Border Patrol, right? So Border Patrol gets involved. And Anderson, instead of being released like any other person in that situation of being accused of that particular crime would have been, he ends up being in Border Patrol custody and then in ICE custody thereafter. during that time when he's in custody, of course, he has a flare-up of sickle cell anemia. He's then goes to the hospital. He's under Border Patrol guard during that time. Doctors have trouble accessing him. His attorneys have trouble accessing him. The nurses who care for him are not sure exactly what the rules are in terms of what areas of the hospital the Border Patrol agents are able to actually enter. That all obviously exacerbates the kind of anxiety and the kind of the care that he's able to actually get, the recovery that he's able to go. He eventually is moved around the country to various detention facilities. And at some point, the family makes a decision that this is all too painful, that we can't actually undergo this in the United States. It's far better for us to leave, to go back to South America, than to undergo this kind of what I think they understood to be to be torture, right? To actually not know at what point, under what conditions, this son, who is medically vulnerable, would be actually released from custody. And they self-deport. And they would rather keep the family together than risk Anderson being deported and the family being separated. Now, so there's a whole host of protections for the right to health, right? For that initial stop, right? That the police officer did the police officer have?
And just to be clear, if I read you correctly in the report, the Cheektowaga Town Justice dismissed this case.
Exactly, right? That tells you, right, that if the normal criminal justice process had been allowed to move forward, right, irrespective of immigration status, it would be so low level that it's not worth the time of the criminal justice system to actually take it seriously and go through all the way through a criminal prosecution. So that case was dismissed, right? And yet, Anderson was still in the custody of CBP because of the Laken Riley Act. Detention was mandatory, right? So he's funneled into the federal immigration system, all because you have a Cheektowaga police officer doubting the identity of this person and getting federal immigration agents involved. So the kind of the line of the report is that the story of Anderson and his family would not have happened the way that it did were it not for the involvement of the local police. And so what that tells us is that there's something going wrong with the way that the local police, if they are concerned, right, justly so, about making sure to enforce the law, to fight crime, to keep the community safe, what protections need to be built in such that that does not happen? Because that's something that, you know, Anderson was completely here and following the rules, right? And potential criminal activity would never have risen to the level that it should have triggered all these things. And in some ways, it was only because the Cheektowaga police officer decided to actually directly get CBP involved, right, that it led to that.
So the New York For All Act, I would, and we can get into the specifics of that for sure, but if that were the case, that call would not have been made by the police officer. Would there be, though, at the same time, some other method or channel that an officer could have used in that situation to confirm whether or not, you know, these were legal documents or this person was who he said he was?
Absolutely, right? I mean, police officers confirm identities all the time, right? And in the first instance, the whole point of asking for the identification is just to ID who Anderson is, right? If we don't always carry our IDs. I know that it's often mandated, but we often don't because we think we live in a free society where these kinds of things are not. We don't have to always show our papers, right? That's part of living in some ways a freer society. So police officers often encounter people that they need to corroborate what their identity is, but they have all sorts of ways to contact people in the community, people, you know, in the neighborhood, in their school. That the whole point of having police that know the community is precisely that you can go to the community and various institutions.
So in a way, we can say that the federal, this is an example where federal authorities undermine community building.
I think that's right, right? The threat of having federal authorities involved, right, I think does undermine that. Or the kind of ease with which a local police officer might say, well, I can just call my buddy in Border Patrol, right, to check these documents, right? I think that that's not the right way to think about kind of verifying somebody's identity. And I think it asks local police to have, I think exactly the way that you frame the conversation, it asks local police to have in their heads, well, does this person really belong? Is this person illegally? That's the way I'm going to think about this. There is this, you know, in Anderson's case, I think that the police officer, you know, said that they were worried that there was a fraudulent ID. Now, these things are very, very complicated, right? It's not exactly clear to me what training the officer had to doubt the authenticity of that identification, right? So we can go down that route. But I think the point is that there were other ways to actually ascertain the identification of this person in front of you that relies on community policing and the ways that it would happen where if you or I would be questioned by the police instead of going through the federal immigration system. So as you said, New York for All would prevent that kind of contacting immigration enforcement using a lot of times, you know, Cheektowaga police and Tonawanda police as well. There are instances where you have police officers calling on Border Patrol not to ID somebody, but to ask, serve as interpreters. So somebody doesn't speak English very well. They don't necessarily know what's the language they're comfortable with. So they call somebody from the Federal Immigration Service because they have some kind of familiarity with people from different language backgrounds. Again, New York for All would make that unlawful.
Okay.
Right? So it would create some kind of hermetic seal, except in cases where federal law mandates that for certain kind of programs, you actually have to ask about immigration status. But the point is that New York for All would mean that you just do not ask about immigration status. Your goal, as in the case of police officers, is simply to enforce the criminal law, the state criminal law. Insofar as you need to ID somebody to do that, right? There are other ways to do that apart from actually invoking the relationships with Border Patrol and ICE. And so I think that the New York for All stands for this idea that these are public services. It doesn't apply just to police, but police say mainly. There are public services that the police provides that they can provide ably and better if that connection with federal immigration enforcement is cut. Except in cases, of course, where there's clear evidence of a federal criminal immigration violation. But those, again, are going to be incredibly rare. And police have to be trained on exactly what that means. I think that that's the kind of the hope of New York for All to kind of draw some kind of hermetic seal between state and local agencies, including law enforcement, from communication with federal immigration enforcement.
And we're going to be going to break, but I think this is a good question to end on before we move on to some other aspects of this subject matter. What we're talking about here is not in any way trying to shield criminals, right? You know, true criminal activity. We kind of got into this earlier with the idea that this situation at the Galleria may or may not have been a shoplifting case. But we're talking about in a case of whatever level you want to, you're the law professor, I'll let you to describe what level of criminality we're talking about here. But we're not talking about shielding criminals from what could be a deportation.
Of course not. And I think that my students, I talked about this quite a bit because I think that there is a very real worry in the public's eye that, of course, we don't want to undermine the ability of law enforcement to actually keep the public safe. Right. And human rights, of course, has a role to play in making sure that police don't overstep in that. We have constitutional protections. But of course, we have a duty to introduce some kind of standards of public safety to enforce criminal law. I think that the response is that we have to have faith in our criminal justice system to do that.
Right.
We can't use the federal immigration enforcement system to do that work for us, right? That in some ways that once somebody goes through and is prosecuted according to the standards of the constitutional rights that we have under our criminal process, once somebody is actually convicted, right, of a crime, only then can we actually call them a criminal. Right.
Right.
Before that, it's just allegations, right? We have certain kind of suspicions that they might have committed a crime, but before that, actually, criminal justice system has a chance to work through when people actually get their day in court, right? They are convicted by a jury. At that point, right, then we can say, well, those are criminals. Then we can actually say that they are having some kind of sentence, right? And then there are databases that, of course, are shared with the federal, federal government, and ICE and CBP can act in those kinds of ways. What's happening here is that you have, in advance of any kind of criminal adjudication, right, you have the ascription of criminality of somebody who might be, suspected of committing a crime, who then is having the federal immigration enforcement agency come down very hard on them, initiate removal proceedings, right? Often before we have any kind of confidence that we were actually getting criminals. Now, of course, there are, the story has been, you talked about the secretary earlier, right? Is that we're deporting the worst of the worst, right? The people who have criminal records and so on. When you look at the numbers, that's just flatly wrong. The entire growth of the deportations and removals that we've seen in the second Trump administration are all people who have no criminal records at all. The people who have had criminal records, who have already served their time, who have been identified as now removable, those people have been removed far earlier, right? Under the Obama administration, the first Trump administration, under Biden. What we have now is a far more aggressive mass deportation policy that is targeting not criminals at all, but people who are just here illegally. And again, that goes to the conversation that we had at the start. These are people who are not do not pose a threat to this country, at least the way that we express considerations of threat through our criminal law, right? These are people who might have violated some kind of law, but they might have been in this country for 10 years, built a family, have had a job, have roots in the society, and none of that is being taken into account. And again, to bring the point home, these are people who are now being made more vulnerable because state and local agencies have this communication pipeline, or because police are holding people longer than they should, right, and actually funneling people into the federal immigration deportation process in ways that are not targeting criminals in the first instance.
There's a lot inside this report. We're going to get to more of it, as a matter of fact, including what might be the long-term impact of complicity between state and local officials with federal immigration enforcement. We'll continue our conversation with Paul Lyndon Reddick from the UB School of Law, coming up next on What's Next, here on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Buffalo Toronto Public Media, The Bridge. Made by music lovers and powered by listener support. Locally owned and operated. Always independent. This is Public Media.
At Buffalo Toronto Public Media, we're committed to serving our entire community. Whether you're listening to investigative journalism on BTPM NPR, enjoying world-class performances on BTPM Classical, discovering new local artists on BTPM The Bridge, or immersing yourself in mysteries on BTPM PBS, Public Media has something for everyone. Explore programs that matter to you at btpm.org. This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And thanks for joining us today on What's Next. Our guest, Paul Lyndon Reddick, UB School of Law. He and his students put together a report, Ending Complicity, The Harms of State and Local Collusion with Federal Immigration Enforcement. This is available at the UB Law website, and you can find it for yourself as well. And I would encourage you to take a look. But we're going to continue our conversation here. There's so much to this, and I don't want to miss some of the key elements. But I want to talk about the impact that we're seeing when it comes to education. This is a very interesting part of that. We've kind of spent our first part of this conversation focusing on law enforcement, police, and the possible impacts that being complicit with immigration authorities on certain cases can have. But when it comes to education, this is something that, you know, we're talking about children now. What are you finding? What are the things that stand out so far for you in this?
This was a particularly poignant, difficult section of the report to write. We had a wonderful student take the lead on this who had personal experience with these kinds of questions and fears. The worry is that when ICE has lifted the kind of sensitive locations policy that previously exempted schools from this being the site of immigration enforcement. Now you have schools, school administrators, school resource officers, right? Police officers who might be in schools. Those are become all points of potential collaboration and cooperation with federal immigration enforcement, sometimes not intentionally. Sometimes you have a school administrator who's trying to resolve a problem. Maybe there's a child that needs help, again, speaking in a language they don't know. How do you help that child? The intention might not be to implicate that child or that child's family in removal proceedings, but the uncertainty of that means that children are expressing fears of going to school. If they do go to school and actually attend, they are expressing a difficulty learning, feeling like they can actually be there with their classmates, speaking freely, learning, growing, experimenting with different ideas. They're worried that the accent in which they might speak will alert somebody that maybe they come from a particular background, maybe they don't have status. So that affects, in the first instance, the child.
Right.
The child's access to a fundamental right of education, recognized certainly in international human rights law, but in our constitutional law as well. There's a sense that we particularly care, I think, about children feeling like that they actually can belong in our society, that they have a space to be themselves. We talked about this before the taping, but there's a wonderful case from 1982, Plyler versus Doe, where Justice Brennan speaks very, very beautifully about a prohibition on excluding undocumented children from public education, because we are worried about creating a permanent underclass of people who are excluded from civic life, who don't actually learn what it is to participate in our society. And so we have that side from excluding children, depriving them of a right to education, with all the kinds of psychological.
I wanted to make sure that we make that the point here, though. That 1982 case from the Supreme Court made it the law of the land that undocumented children still have access to public education.
That's right. That's right. Public education, public schools cannot exclude students on the basis of their immigration status. And so what happens now with collusion is that you have no formal bar, right? But the anxiety around possible cooperation with different members of the school administration, again, not always intentionally, right? Or the worry that police officers, right, who might have relationships with CBP or ICE, are working as school resource officers, right? There's a certain kind of sense that there's now some kind of surveillance or possible kind of pipelines for communication with federal immigration enforcement in schools that would alert federal immigration to somebody, maybe their family, if not the student themselves, of not having status. That, in practice, undermines the vision of Plyler, because it means that students are hard-pressed to believe that they can fully and safely go to school. There are many studies that point to all sorts of psychological and developmental harm that come when students are not able to feel like they can learn and be safe in school. And then you also have parents, right? Parents who are not accompanying their kids to school, are not picking them up from school, are not going to parent-teacher conferences, right? Think about what it would be like as a parent to say, I can't engage with the life of my child in school in the same way that their parents can. The child begins to ask questions about, well, why aren't you as involved as you know, my friend's parents are? That creates all sorts of very difficult conversations in the home, fears in the home. It introduces a level of anxiety that I think for anyone who is a parent, I'm not a parent, but I can imagine what you fear for your child, and you, knowing that your child might be fearful of what might happen to you. A lot of these cases might involve children of mixed status families, where one parent might not have status, but the other might. Think about what that might, you might be worried, not just that your entire family might be vulnerable, but your parents might be separated on account of something that you said in school. It's an incredible, traumatic psychological experience to have to go through if you're a child, wondering about where the next kind of vulnerability comes when you're just trying to actually learn and better yourself in school. We have cases where children are met at school bus stops by federal agents. And if you're the school bus driver, what do you do, knowing that there are going to be agents waiting for you when you open that door and the child leaves your protection, that they might be subject to some kind of interrogation, that they might be waiting for the parents to come to pick them up. There's a need, and I think what comes out of this report is there is a need for clarity from the schools and from the school districts. The Buffalo public school system has done a good job of this, but I think it needs help in working with other state and local authorities to make sure that we telegraph very clearly what the rights of children are, what the privacy protections in place are, and how they relate to immigration status information in particular. Protocols for knowing what happens when ICE does potentially come on or near campus. What are the non-public areas of campus or schools that ICE cannot go without a judicial warrant? All these things have to be telegraphed very, very clearly to students and their parents to kind of counter that sense of anxiety and fear and uncertainty. And in the absence of that clear protocol being in place, I think it is the case that Western New York school districts are in some ways complicit, right, in making students and their families more vulnerable. And I think that it's a call to make sure that those kinds of protocols are in place. There's a limit, of course, to what state and local authorities can do lawfully to resist federal immigration actions.
Right.
But at the very least, they have to they have a positive obligation to do all they can to make sure that those federal immigration actions are done lawfully. And insofar as there's unlawful behavior by those federal agents, there are protections in place to guard against that as much as is possible.
And while we're talking a lot about the law, and the law, you know, has its own certain hypothetical, I guess we'll use it as the term when it comes to how things get played out. But going back to this case, and I saw it in the report about ICE agents waiting at a bus stop, which I'll let that one sink into everybody else and imagine it for themselves. What do we know about the impact on the students involved here? Do we know anything about that?
Yeah. Well, so the students were traumatized. There was a group of older students, your older siblings, that I think were able to kind of be helpful in kind of making sure that the younger siblings were not so scared, right? But the story there is that the students were deeply traumatized by that experience. They were unsure about what the intentions were. The federal agents were inquiring in terms of all sorts of kind of welfare-based questions, asking about where their parents were and so on. So there was a kind of a deep anxiety from that. The kind of interviews that we conducted showed that there was evidence of some kind of post-traumatic stress that the students, of course, experienced as a result of that. So anytime, you know, day in and day out, they would go on that same route and wonder when they turn that corner if they will be met by agents again. And so even that level of uncertainty itself imposes incredible harm. There was a desire not to go to school, right, to just avoid that anxiety and uncertainty altogether. And again, there was a kind of a sense of to whom do I turn? So do I ask the bus driver to call? In that instance, the bus driver actually called the local police to intervene. And in that case, the police were very helpful because they actually made sure that the federal agents, they were kind of clarifying what exactly the federal agents were after and what exactly they were doing. And they seemed to kind of be on, the children perceived that the police were on their side, that they weren't alone anyway. But you can imagine, right, depending on which jurisdiction, that story could have actually worked its way out very differently, depending on what the orientation of the police was. It put an incredible burden on the bus driver to make that decision about what to do. Do I actually unload the kids? Do I open the doors of the bus? If I open the doors, do the agents have a right to come in? All these kinds of questions, some of them are legal, some of them are just prudential, right? Those come up. And again, the bus driver needs some kind of clarity, some kind of training, what exactly they're supposed to do. They need to have an awareness of, well, who are the authorities in place who I can call, and what is their relationship to federal immigration enforcement? If they are in a jurisdiction that has one of these 287 agreements, that are formal agreements to cooperate with ICE, well, am I going to actually call the police then? And if not, who do I call? Do I have the contact information of these parents that I can make sure that I know where they are? There's a whole host of kind of protocols in place that I think are important to think about. And that I think that would allay some of the anxiety of the children, even as I think you rightly put, even the mere fact of having agents at a bus stop, I think, is so devastating to the kind of sense of security and safety that in itself, I think, speaks for that advises that we actually have gone a little bit awry, and that the sense of locations policy really should be reinstated. But there are things that the local school boards and school administrators and the principals can do to at least institute some kind of protocols and to telegraph those, to convey those clearly to the parents and to the students, that we know what to do when these kinds of things happen. We are with you. We understand what you're worried about. We will work through this together.
And you mentioned the 287G agreements. There are a couple of police agencies in Western New York that do have those agreements with federal ICE.
That's right. There are about four or five that have over the years. There's many more, about, you know, 9, 11. It's changing across New York State as entirely. But in Western New York, Cattaraugus and Steuben County have had ones. Niagara County for a long time has had a model in place only very recently, actually, only in the wake of Minneapolis, in the wake of some of the protests that have garnered attention. Has there been public pressure on the Niagara County Sheriff's Office to limit that agreement? Not entirely, but there would be no kind of formal cooperation. The task force model, where there's a few variants of the 287G model, but one is that you basically have local police deputized to actually, you know, participate in federal immigration enforcement actions. The Niagara County Sheriff has since said that that is no longer the policy. That said, Niagara County still does engage in communication between them and federal immigration enforcement. They do, in certain circumstances, hold in their detention facilities people who ICE is asking them to hold or detain them a little bit longer on these they do honor the detainer requests. If ICE identifies somebody that they want, who Niagara County has in custody, to hold them a little bit until they can get custody. It seems like that those kinds of operations are still ongoing. The worst of the kind of formal cooperation is being toned down, but it doesn't mean that cooperation doesn't happen. But yeah, the formal agreements, there are only a handful in Western New York that have these formalized, deputized relationships. One part of the report is to say those, of course, are problematic and they've been challenged as such in various federal and state courts, some successfully, some not. But even in the absence of 287G agreements, there are informal ways that police departments cooperate, that they honor immigration detainer requests, even without some kind of formal arrangement. You have an ecosystem where they know that the police know that there is some kind of authority to turn to, that they are being requested by ICE and CBP to hold people that are presently in their custody a little bit longer until they can pick them up. Those kinds of cooperation and information sharing and acting on detainer requests still does happen even in the absence of 287G agreements that actually formalize that relationship.
I'm going to take a time out because we're flying by in this hour with Paul Lyndon Reddick talking about the UB School of Law, the report, Ending Complicity, the Harms of State and Local Collusion with Federal Immigration Enforcement. When we come back, we're going to take a look at perhaps some of the long-term implications of the current, lack of a better term, current atmosphere around the issue of immigration and deportation. We'll come back with more. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
What is BTPM Plus? It's an evolution of Buffalo Toronto Public Media that brings you the best of PBS, where you can watch your favorite programs live and dig into collections curated just for you. And here's the best part. When you stream BTPM Plus, you're not just watching, you're supporting your local public media station, the journalism, the arts, and the storytelling that keeps our community connected. Visit btpm.org/plus today. Stream smarter, stream local.
A downed tree, a broken bike or two, and hundreds of miles between Buffalo and Brooklyn. That's the journey in Rolling Through, a new video series from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Producer Pat Kelly is biking the Empire State Trail, exploring nature, culture, and how eco-friendly travel can connect us to the places we visit.
Oh, we are getting rain soon.
Cool,
we
can wrap it's it. Coming.
New episodes of Rolling Through arrive every week. Watch on the BTPM YouTube channel and BTPM Plus.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And welcome back to What's Next. Professor Paul Lyndon Reddick of the UB School of Law with us today, talking about the report put together by his students, Ending Complicity, the Harms of State and Local Collusion with Federal Immigration Enforcement. But there's so much to this, and we're really not going to have time to get into the impact of collusion between local and federal authorities when it comes to labor, when it comes to healthcare. We may not be able to really get into that, because I want to get into this. One of the parts of their executive summary, the key findings, and I'm going to read it verbatim and we can discuss it. This exclusion of individuals or populations from the protection of law contributes to a broader societal acceptance of hierarchical distinctions between individuals. This, in turn, creates a fertile environment for future rights violations, as the state and society accept that some lives are unworthy of rights. Over time, this dissolves social cohesion, weakens the legitimacy of democratic institutions, and encourages the arbitrary and violent exercise of power. That is a daunting and dark statement there for sure, but this, obviously, you and your students did your work, researched this, compared it to international law. Let's expand on that a little bit. It's a daunting statement. And the report in itself is of that, but there's a lot of cases in there. There's a lot of comparisons in there. But now we're looking at maybe what could be coming from the future of this hyper focus on deporting people who are not criminals.
I think it's a testament to the students that they wanted to speak to that question that you quoted from the report. For them, this is an essential element of living in a society that subscribes to the rule of law, that protects the rights of individuals, that believes in social standing that's equal, that we don't permit hierarchical distinctions from developing in our society where some are permanently excluded. Speaking personally as their teacher, I was very moved by the students wanting to speak to that aspect, because they are young lawyers. They're about to be attorneys. Some of them are by now already practicing. Some of them are immigration attorneys.
They're immigration attorneys.
Some of them are.
We've heard that there's a major exodus from that field.
And there's a huge need for people to, talented young attorneys to go into this field to represent people going through these proceedings. The students are inheriting a world in which increasingly our public life has become lawless, at least pockets of it. And I think for them, it is a question of sustaining democracy and what democracy really demands. I think if you look around society, if you go and if you go to your local supermarket, if the first thing that you are wondering about somebody else is, do they really belong here? Right? Is this somebody who I want to accept as my neighbor? Then you actually undermine the kind of the fabric of society. Right? That's not the vision, I think, of a country and a public under law, where everyone has equal standing under the law. You might have violated the law in some respects, but you are not deprived of your rights because of that. And we don't prejudge your rights on account of who you are, just based on what kind of papers you have. So I think that this is, for the students, a kind of a call to take a moment to hear the stories of the people that they've interviewed. That those stories, I think, indicate a certain kind of collapse of equality and of justice and of democracy, that I think if we permit to go on, and I think if, more precisely, if state and local communities are complicit in that collapse, right, we actually lose something quite essential about our free society. And I think that there's so much about federal immigration policy that seems so misguided and so cruel and so punitive. We have 400,000 deportations, 70,000 people detained across the country. 53 people died in ICE detention last year. It's already 15 people this year. That's about a death every 6 days. Those kinds of numbers, those kinds of experiences, the cruel and inhuman detention conditions, those are things that feel overwhelming to try to fight against. We should, and we should protest those things. But I think we have an opportunity at the local level, at the state level, to say, we have far greater control over what our local Erie County Sheriff's Office does, or the Niagara County Sheriff's Office does, what our local schools do to protect our neighbors. And if we can reclaim that kind of approach to say, we're going to defend our constitutional rights, draw on international law that tells us that other states around the world are telling us that what we're doing is not quite right. If we can reclaim that sense and sensibility towards protecting the rule of law and protecting essential human rights, then I think we can build some kind of resistance to the broader federal policy. But I think it begins by reclaiming a sense of our values at home. And I think that that's what the students are asking us to pay attention to. If this kind of abuse of power isn't checked, and some of these instances that we talk about seem quite innocent, right? It's not necessarily malicious. People are just trying to ascertain what the identity is, right? But we have to be more mindful of people's rights and safety and be much more thoughtful about when we are putting people in harm's way. And if we can kind of institute that kind of culture in our basic institutions, from the DMV to the local police, to the school boards, to the us walking down the street, I think we have a chance of reclaiming some of those essential democratic values that we're in danger of losing at the national level.
I appreciate the optimistic note there for sure. And just to follow up on something that was also attached inside the report, the city of Buffalo, Mayor Ryan recently made his own declaration on how the city was going to approach it. But I cited this report, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the Ryan administration was very kind in reaching out to ask about the report and ask about, they want to know what stories we've compiled, what kind of legal analysis was. We met with Corporation Counsel, with other groups that have been working on this issue to suggest ways that the executive order can be framed to be effective, right, to cover the kinds of the instances of information sharing and of cooperation that we're kind of mindful of. I think it was a courageous act that the mayor did. Notably, right, we have a very decentralized law enforcement structure in New York State. So it covers the Buffalo Police Department, but it doesn't cover the Erie County Sheriff's Office. And I think that there is, especially after the killing of Mr. Shah Alam, I think there's a question, right, that there were many points of failure in that story, including by the Erie County Sheriff's Office, that I think we need to have some kind of broader legislation at the state level to cover everything. But that's right. I think that the mayor acted quite courageously to institute some kind of sanctuary policies, to be very clear that one of his first acts in office was to set exactly that signal to reclaim democracy and the rule of law and equality for everybody. So I think it was a very welcome signal. I think now the ball is in the New York State Legislature's court. And we'll see if some kind of meaningful legislation can pass this session.
And that's the New York for All Act.
That's right.
You support it.
We do. It's the most robust bill that would prohibit cooperation between state and local agencies and federal immigration enforcement. There's a lot to be said. Governor Hochul has her own brand of this. It's not quite as robust as the New York for All Act. So I think that there is a conversation that we should have about which bill to support and kind of what the politics is behind that. I'd encourage people to read the New York for All Act. It's not very long, and to think about what it covers, to compare it to the bill proposed by Governor Hochul. I think as long as we're talking about these things, understanding the gravity of the stories that people are sharing with us, that of the scenarios that people are undergoing, if we can keep that in mind, I think we'll have a chance to work past this. One thing I would say is that it's very important, and this is another thing that the human rights lens brings to the picture, which is often overlooked. It's one thing to actually have a good policy in place to prohibit certain kinds of actions, to set the guidelines right. It's another to actually have robust mechanisms of reporting and monitoring and oversight built into that legislation. And I think one thing that the students spoke at great length in our discussions about, but and introduced as key recommendations, that's not quite reflected exactly in the same way in the New York for All Act even, is to actually have some kind of consistent monitoring of compliance with these policies and a mechanism, a kind of a public body that can take complaints from the public when such violations happen, not just through the Attorney General's office, but a more kind of public, maybe a human rights commission that would actually hear these claims, to bring that kind of process a little bit closer to the public and not just through the AG's office. But I think to think in the human rights lens about, well, these are things that have to be actually complied with. How do we know that they're being complied with? Do people actually have access to meaningful oversight and monitoring mechanisms, and how to design those? So I think the New York for All Act is an enormous step in the right direction. We should think more deeply about monitoring and oversight as well, as a society, that irrespective of what the New York State Legislature does, how do we actually build robust institutions to make sure that we actually abide by the laws that we pass?
You can find out more about the New York for All Act, of course. You've heard Professor Paul Lyndon Reddick encourage you to read that. I'm going to encourage you to read Ending Complicity, The Harms of State and Local Collusion with Federal Immigration Enforcement, put together by the UB School of Law students and overseen by Professor Paul Lyndon Reddick, our guest today on What's Next. Thanks so much for your time. Obviously, we just scratched the surface of a complex but difficult and very emotional topic, and I think we were able to pull a little bit of that out and get into some of the meat of things. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.